A lot of news in the Red Stars world this week. Probably the busiest, one of the busiest set of days in the club's history, Brian.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as has become all too common with the Red Stars and women's soccer, the good stuff on the field is overshadowed by other developments.
Yeah, very mixed. You know, the Red Stars make the playoffs. Well, first of all, they had to know that they even had a chance to make the playoffs on Sunday. So Saturday, they get the good news. They got some help. Sunday, they get the result. Monday, the Sally Yates report from U.S. Soccer, funded by U.S. Soccer, I guess would be the way to phrase that, comes out. And, you know, and the Red Stars are back in the limelight for negative reasons. And we're going to lead with the Sally Yates report. I guess I'll get the intro out of the way that this is the Chicago Soccer Conversation. That's Brian Sandalow, the Chicago Fire beat writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. I am Dan Santaromita, a sports betting editor at The Athletic. So it's all about the Red Stars this week. The Fire were already eliminated. We'll get to them towards the end of the show, and we'll get to the on-the-field stuff for the Red Stars, but we have to talk about the Sally Yates report first. Brian, I want to, you know, but we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty. I think we're going to take our time and try and dissect this properly. But I want kind of your broad general reaction to what you've read from that report.
Well, my first reaction is the same reaction that I had when the original Washington Post reporting came out, is two things. First of all, kudos to Kristen Press for continuously trying to get some eyeballs and some serious investigation and some consequences into what was going on with the Red Stars. And second, Arnim Whistler has to go. He absolutely has to be removed from NWSL. If that means forcing him to sell, if that means just suspending him indefinitely, whatever, the Chicago Red Stars cannot move forward as long as Arnim Whistler is involved with them. If that means that the other owners stage like some sort of an uprising against him, or the league boots him, or U.S. Soccer, or whoever, Arnim Whistler cannot be a part of women's soccer anymore. That's just a fact. And I don't see how there's any argument against that.
Yeah. In fact, just to throw it out there, I saw an op-ed in the USA Today by Nancy Armour taking the same stance about Arnim, and as well as Portland's owner, Merritt Paulson, our Portland Thorns owner, well, Timbers as well. But so, yeah, that's not a, you know, there's a definitely growing, that opinion is growing in numbers. And certainly I know we've seen some of the Red Star supporters groups have been calling for Arnim out for a while. And I don't expect that to change. So we'll see what's going to happen, but I guess we need to get into it, Brian, kind of, you know, not the nitty gritty details. We'll leave some of that out. We don't need to get that graphic because there is some pretty gross stuff in there, but a lot of that we knew of already. I think this is, you know, from the previous Washington Post report, but I think this Sal Yates report is different in the way, you know, it comes at what happened leading to that. There's more information. And because he was already removed, I think it was probably easier for her to get a hold of people, and the fact she had the Federation funding it and backing and this report. So just to get into how this happens, I think this is important to get into what this is, right? You know, U.S. Soccer hired Sally Yates, you know, former, you know,
deputy attorney
level,
general.
Yeah, yeah. Like a high level federal attorney that has got some notoriety in the political world, and here is doing something for U.S. Soccer. This is an independent investigation. That's what they hired her for. It touches on issues relating to, you know, we said Portland. Some of the Paul Riley stuff, which touches on Portland and North Carolina. There's some Louisville Sky Blue stuff in there. And then, of course, the Red Stars and Roy Dames get a section. It's over 150 pages. There's 38 dedicated to the Dames and to Roy Dames and the Red Stars. I've not read the whole thing, but I did read the Red Stars Roy Dames section. They used over 200 interviews and got some documents, emails, etc. So this was an exhaustive report, right? Journalists can do some of this, but when you get the Federation and the league, you know, they're kind of almost required more so than they would be when a journalist doing it. Even so, there is a mention in the report the Red Stars delayed the production of relevant documents and initially, and now this is a quote I'm reading from the report, initially sought to narrow the scope of our investigation by declining to produce documents beyond those relating directly to Roy Names. The Red Stars have partially retreated from that position, but we have had to obtain documents from other cooperating sources to supplement their incomplete production.
Who do you think was behind that? Was that Whistler, or do you think that was somebody in the front office acting on Whistler's behalf, or was it somebody employed by Whistler who was trying to protect him?
I don't know, and to be honest, as exhaustive as this is, I don't know that it's necessarily productive to speculate on that because...
No speculation. It's just a question that I had reading that section.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I almost don't think it matters because they're all kind of the same answer, aren't they? Like you're talking about how the schematics of that happened, and I think the result is the same either way, right? So,
yeah. But it just shows that the organization didn't really learn from anything. Is that fair? That you'd think that you would want full transparency, but I guess not.
Yeah, 100%. I don't fully understand why you would, because look, and you know this sentence is there, this paragraph or whatever is in there because of that, and you know you're not going to win. And maybe that was what it ultimately came down to, is they wanted to not cooperate and realize they really had no choice, and it would look worse if they didn't. We do have a comment from the Chicago Red Stars on this, or I guess more specifically from Arnim Whistler. Brian, did you make anything out of this?
Well, I just, if you haven't seen it, but I'm sure you have, that he's stepping back from governance of the Red Stars and their day-to-day operations. But really, the only thing I made of it is that there's no real accountability from him. He said he's sorry for what our players experienced during their time spent in Chicago, but there's no real apology for his role in what they experienced in Chicago. That apology is passive and more or less is passing the blame to Rory Dames. I mean, who does, of course, have a lot of blame in this, but so does Arnim Whistler, and there's no real acknowledgement of that. So I can't say I was surprised by this statement, and frankly, I can't say I was disappointed because I wouldn't expect anything else from him at this point.
Yeah, I think the thing that's weird is we saw, I want to say there was something earlier where he was kind of already referring to stepping back, at least as far as the Red Stars part of it, you know, less day-to-day control. So I don't know how different this is. I guess the Board of Governors thing within the league is relevant. You know how I feel about statements, Brian. This is a statement. This is a whatever statement. The statements don't matter. I think he did need to say something, but I think what we need is action more than words.
Right. We absolutely need action, but I think it would be cathartic in a sense if there was some accountability. If he came out and said, I'm not just sorry for what our players went through, but I'm sorry for what our players went through because of my inaction. I think that would help a little bit.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing we're going to be looking for. I don't know that we will see that verbatim, but I still think, you know, the fans are going to keep pushing for Arnim out. And I think eventually I think it will have to happen, but this is uncharted territory. We'll see.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Red Stars aren't the only team going through this. Portland has made some changes in their front office because of the report, but there needs to be real change, and it can't just be changing owners. There has to be a whole mentality change in these teams and in NWSL as a whole. Because eventually, if this crap continues, you wonder if corporate sponsors are going to want to continue being involved with NWSL and if that could kill the league eventually.
Yeah, turbulent times in the league for sure. I haven't seen the league comment yet, although this kind of is the league commenting in a weird way.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously the league front office is involved in cooperating with this, so I don't know that we necessarily need the league to respond to something that's kind of coming, not directly from them, but close to.
Right, and it's something about statements and whatnot. Yeah, I don't think a statement matters as much as the action, but I do think that the Red Stars brass, whether it's Arnim Whistler or team executives, they should make themselves available to independent media who can ask them a whole bunch of more questions that came up out of this report. That's one way that you can put everything on record, and then they can be held accountable. If the Red Stars say they're going to do A by a certain time, then you can check on that and you can get them on the record.
Okay. To be fair, though, I think that's what this report is. Just because it's not media, that's still an interview process. The information is still there. It's cited as legalese as opposed to journalism, you know, speak or phrasing or whatever, AP style, if you will. But I mean, that's basically what this report is. What these questions are. There are mentions of Rory Dames and Arnim Whistler being asked about certain questions and either not answering or giving written statements through their counsel. There is an explicit mention of that. So I don't mean to disagree with you, Brian, but this is what this report is. It has already happened. They had the information and went to them and kept going to them and got the on the record denial and or no comment.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just thinking that sometimes you get stuff on the record in a report, in a journalistic article, then you can hold them to that a few months later and say, what's the progress on this initiative? How's that going? I think there is a value in that.
Absolutely. But I just don't think it's any different than this in this case. You know, you're putting the name and the quote and the information out there. And yeah, like obviously this needs to happen. And the report does mention there is a section towards the end on recommendations, which is lengthy in its own right. I think it's like 8 pages of recommendations, which is funny in a very twisted way.
Yeah.
Where there is a mention of the Athletic article, Meg Linehan's initial report on Paul Riley, which kind of got the ball rolling on Molly Hensley Clancy's report on Rory Dames and all the others around the league, led to this one and mentioned how, I forget the exact phrasing. I have tons of notes in front of us here, and this one I didn't write down. But basically saying that, you know, reports through the media, whether they're anonymous or otherwise, you know, some of that, and even mentioned the Athletic by name, and Washington Post is mentioned throughout by name, in more in reference to the Rory Dames stuff, about how those avenues need to be open and stay open. So she's obviously giving credit to that as well. So I'm in full agreement. I just think this is basically another version of that.
Yeah, but I think that sunshine is the greatest disinfectant, and sure, one way that you can get sunshine is via journalism. But anyway, we're getting off kilter a little bit here.
Yeah, you're disagreeing with me, even though I'm agreeing with you. Cool.
Summed up the podcast in one sentence.
Oh, yeah, I feel sorry for your wife. So, all right. So one note I want to get to, I think we got like 4 big major notes we have to get to here.
Yeah.
The first one's, I guess, a little bit easier on the discussion side, but there's a quote in the report. It says, on November 20, 2021, a CRS retained sports psychologist concluded that Dames had created a culture of fear and engaged in emotional and verbal abuse, which is psychologically and emotionally harmful to players and staff. And then it later mentions that Dames resigned that day. This might be the only paragraph in the entire report that puts the Red Stars in a positive light.
And even that is damning them with faint praise, because this was way too late, obviously. Right.
And even within that, I'm skeptical of this, because, okay, so this is the timeline of this, of as we saw it, right? And now maybe some of this is where we like get the timeline might be different than we thought. Is Dames resigned, obviously, as it's saying, on that day. But I think everyone thought, because they were made aware of, as you would do in any sort of report that's, you know, of this nature, they were not shown the report that was going to be published, but aware of a number of the allegations.
They knew something was coming. Yeah.
Right. And they knew the big points, I would bet. Like, there were probably some quotes right off, like, this quote's going to be in there, do you have any comment, kind of stuff. So I think we assumed that he resigned because of the Washington Post report was going to come out.
And I think that is a part of it.
I'm sure it still is.
Yeah.
But this is where the timeline gets murky with this. As if to say, I mean, because if you read that paragraph that I just did about CRS retained a sports psychologist basically saying he had created a negative culture. And then he resigns. You could be led to, you could conclude that he resigned because of an internal investigation, so to speak. Or investigation might not be the right word, but similar.
Yeah.
Do you buy that? Because I'm not sure I do.
I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure I buy it. I think that the Washington Post report, it was the catalyst of this, of him resigning when he did. Because you don't resign at 11:53 p.m. Central Time because of an internal report. Maybe if it stays internal and there isn't a Washington Post report coming, you can have time to try to talk to HR. You can have time to talk to Arnim Whistler to plead your case. But I think Rory Dames and the Red Stars knew that the court of public opinion and journalism was going to nail them the next morning. So they tried in that very ham-fisted way to get out ahead of it.
Okay, and that we 100% agree. The thing that I'm skeptical of, and this is where it's like you kind of got to think about how the report, this investigation happened, how they would have come about this information, and maybe, and this is total conspiracy theory, and I said earlier to avoid speculation. Here I am.
Well, here we go.
This,
yeah.
This gives me a, this does as doesn't pass the smell test, right?
Yeah.
It is an impressive coincidence to say that the day that they're going to, I'm trying to phrase this carefully. The day that the Washington Post report is to come out, or they're informed of it, is also the day that this internal thing comes from CRS.
And also happens to psychologist. Be the same weekend of the championship game too.
Well, yeah. Well, that I think the timeline is dictated by the Washington Post report, and I'm guessing.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm guessing they did not know of that just that day. So it's almost like the conspiracy theory part, and this is where I'm treading very dangerous waters here. The conspiracy theory part is they know the Washington Post report is coming out, so they come up with the psychologist to make this investigation and say something to say, oh, we had done our due diligence. It was late, but better late than never kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was on the record, and then Sally Yates get the info and go, well, they did do this thing. And that's where I'm like, kind of, you know, I'm gonna leave it there and you can think what you think.
Yeah, think what you think.
The point is made.
We'll let you fill in the blanks.
Yeah, that one's a little weird to me. Referring to follow-ups, that's something I would be asking more about.
Right.
So there's something I would ask follow-ups. I think in terms of the allegations and their response to them, I think all that's been addressed in the report, or at least asked.
Right.
But that is something that was a weird one. I would follow up on that, and maybe someone will. Hopefully someone will. It's a minor detail, but again, like this is I'm making kind of a big deal out of it, and like you were asking with who's leading them to not cooperate fully initially, it doesn't matter. Your opinion of what should change isn't going to change based on that. It's the same either way. But
yeah, I agree on that part.
Then there's they have a whole section on the eclipse and some of the stuff, which was kind of the most damning stuff, I think, in the Washington Post report. I think the difference here is that the Red Star stuff was worse than we thought, or more commonplace. I think the details are about the same as what we had been previously reported. But I think it's also, again, I think Rory looks about the same as what the previous report had. I think Arnim Whistler looks much worse than the previous report.
Yeah. I don't want to jump ahead too much. That how, when you're hiring somebody to be one of the faces of your organization, if not the face, do you not do a simple background check?
Yeah.
Which would have caught something that would have disqualified him from the job.
Yeah, so that's the next big point, right? Because I think there's some other damning quotes in there, and honestly, I don't think we need this to get into like trigger warning territory. I think you should read the report. It's a sickly compelling read because it's like you can't believe it. But you know, if you're sensitive to some of those things, it can get pretty gross in places. And honestly, Rory's not even the grossest one in there, which is what's sick about it. But As you're referring to the background check, right? So the relationship, it details the relationship between Arnhem and Rory Dames and how that, you know, in 2011 came to be. And it was because he was kind of an internal hire through being a volunteer and then a contractor in the in-between years with the Red Stars when he was at Eclipse. It was they called it a mutually beneficial relationship. Arnhem needed players, and Rory got the exposure of being connected with a professional club, even though the Red Stars were kind of semi-pro for a bit there. So Whistler says he was not aware of the allegations against Dames related to youth players, and if he had any hints of that kind of behavior, he never would have hired Dames. But then the report correctly calls out neither Whistler nor anyone else at the Red Stars ever conducted a background check. So that relates to some of the Arlington Heights reports and all that. Some of that would have come up, and then you dig further and find out. So that's a big issue.
Yeah. It's gross negligence at best.
Yeah.
At best. And it also makes you wonder how keyed in to the soccer community Arnhem Whistler actually was at that point. Because if he was keyed in, you'd have to think somebody would say, hey, Arnhem, are you sure you want to hire this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a strike. That's not good. And I thought it was this is an unrelated detail, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless. There's in this same section, because he mentioned the detail about him coming on as a contractor in 2013 before becoming the team's head coach, or, you know, full-time head coach, I guess. His salary at the end in 2021 was $108,000, which I don't know what I thought I expected them to make or whatever, but there you go. Throughout the number, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
So then the next one is Kristen Press. You mentioned this earlier with the hat tip to Kristen Press. She tried, and I vividly remember, I think it was an Instagram post. I said vividly, and then I immediately forget the first detail. But she, it was when she got traded and had a, I think it was from an airport or something, this video of her sitting waiting in like an airport or something as she's, you know, off to her next team. And, you know, we had such a good team. Sorry to see it go. But like, which was an interesting sentiment because everyone, or the reporting was that she had requested a trade, right?
Right. And she got a lot of flack for that too, if I remember correctly. I know that people turned on her for that.
Yeah, but I think, that's why I vividly remember this because I don't know, I never understood why, right? It's like it didn't, and I think there was a general guess, or maybe there was some rumors around it or any minor bit of reporting that it was him and Rory, or her and Rory did not get along. And I mean, that's putting it mildly, I guess, in retrospect, but yeah, I think, who knows? And so Kristen Press reported to Sunil Gulati, who was the U.S. soccer president, and Jill Ellis, the women's national team, back in 2014, that Dames created a hostile environment. And there's other details in the report, but that's basically the gist of it. The NWSL office, or someone in their front office who is credited in the report, distributed those concerns to Arnhem Whistler, who I don't know where they got this information from or how, but it's not a direct quote, but it's from the report. The verbatim is Whistler complained the national team players wanted this, quote, this league to shut down, end quote, and simply had a, quote, axe to grind, end quote, with Dames. Dames offered to resign in light of his complaints, but Whistler declined to accept.
Wow. Yikes.
And that's like, even like that, like Dames offering to resign is like, you know.
Did we know that before this report?
No, I don't believe so.
I don't think so either. Yeah. So yeah. Arnhem Whistler knew. Sunil Gulati knew, and Jill Ellis knew, and
right.
I wonder how can Jill Ellis stay in her position right now?
Well, so again, and I want to, before we go too far on calling for everyone's heads, I want to make clear separation here, and you may not change your opinion, but I want to delineate these two things.
Okay.
What they knew was the verbal and emotional abuse of Red Stars players. I don't believe, or at least it's not confirmed, that they knew of the grosser stuff, which is with Eclipse.
Yeah.
So that is a noteworthy distinction. It may not change your opinion.
And there is something that is subjective about, I'm trying to be careful here, something subjective about the emotional and psychological stuff. What's hard coaching maybe to one person is abuse to another.
Right. But I think the point that comes across, and there's another detail here. I'll read this quote because it's kind of what you're leading to. Players and staff recall raising complaints about Dame's verbal and emotional abuse nearly every year that he coached at CRS. One player, for example, remarked that she raised concerns about Dame's to Whistler over multiple years, and every year Whistler would ask, was he a little bit better this year? The player eventually stopped reporting Dame's behavior to Whistler, declaring it a, quote, lost cause. So that's where you're trying to maybe give benefit of the doubt, or in a certain scenario, you could say, you know, like you said, to one player is abusive versus another is hard coaching. When it's repeated and it's reported over and over, and there's several, like there was a mention that presses complaints or whatever you want to, concerns were backed up by internal NWSL player surveys in 2014 and 2015. So this wasn't like 2% of players, a couple players pissed off. This isn't the axe to grind territory. This is like widespread. Yeah, this is what it is.
Yeah. And it wasn't just hard coaching. If you read the report, some of the things Rory Dame said and did went way beyond hard coaching. It was abuse. And even that, before the Eclipse stuff, which we'll get to, that was fireable enough.
Yeah. And I think that's it. I know, Brian, I don't know if do you even want to get into the Eclipse stuff? Cause I know that's mostly not new territory at this point.
I would,
we've talked, look, I get the quick summary is the sexualized team environment. I don't really want to go into the nitty gritty details. They're in the report. I think if you care enough, you should read at least the Red Stars section. I think it's an incredibly meticulously written report. You know, like I said, this is very much a lawyer's writing, but it's, you know, efficient in the words and careful in the language. And I think a must read if you can handle it. I don't really want to get into how gross some of that is. I think we kind of talked about it before. Like I said, the report doesn't change my opinion of Dames that we didn't already know, but it did change my opinion of Whistler. I don't know if there's anything you want to add otherwise, though, Brian. Go ahead.
It didn't change my opinion of Whistler. It just kind of confirmed everything and intensified my thoughts a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, so I want you to summarize this, because I'm not sure I have a fully formed opinion on who needs to be fired. I don't know that my opinion matters in this, in terms of like me saying someone, I don't like that position in general, right?
Right. Yeah. When it comes to a lot more trivial stuff like results on the field, I was even uncomfortable calling for Georg Heitz to be dismissed. Right. And this is a totally different, situation here.
But it is the same discussion in terms of what it means. You know, it's a different level, not even in, you know, in the same stratosphere of the issues involved. Of course not. But anytime you're calling for someone to lose their job, there's, you know,
right,
when you're not involved directly in that. Like, again, the Red Stars supporters groups calling for it, I think, is actually the most appropriate place for it, because that's where you get into the ownership of a club is, you know, our owners technically just stewards of a club, and then they move on and the fans are there forever kind of thing. So I think that's great that they have their opinion. And I think it's hard to say that Whistler should stay. I think that's a very hard thing to say. When you get beyond that, that's when I think it gets murkier in terms of, like, you're talking about Jill Ellis and Sunil Gulati, how much they knew and how much it means for the rest of their reputations. And when you get into the further degrees of separation, I hesitate more.
Yeah. Well, I know that Jeff Plush, the former commissioner of NWSL, who's now is in charge of and of USA Curling, of all things. I think I saw a report that USA Curling is now looking into his status.
Right.
So I think the ramifications of this will be long lasting. And look, NWSL, women's soccer, the Red Stars have to make significant changes, and they have to commit to those changes, because this was obviously uncalled for. It was disgusting. It goes against their supposed ethos of promoting women's soccer and women's and female athletes. There has to be real change out of this. We can't be hearing about something similar in 3 years that, oh, nothing changed. The attention span of the country and soccer and sports fans went away from this, so things just reverted. There has to be significant change to this. And anybody who was around before this report and then will stick around after, they have to read that report. They have to take all of its messages to heart and realize what they have to do going forward to make sure this crap never happens again. Ever.
Yeah. And I know you said you didn't read the whole thing, and I certainly haven't either. There is a mention, I don't even remember where it is, actually, I shouldn't say. There is a mention in the report about calling it, first of all, uses the phrase systemic issues, or systemic for sure. And basically says it's bigger than the NWSL, it's across youth soccer. And in reality, it's really across all sports, right? This isn't, there's been some back and forth. It's not just men that are the offenders in, you know, sport wide in this story. It is, or in this report, to say the main characters are all men, and they may be in the majority of cases, but it goes beyond the professional league. In fact, I mean, obviously, in terms of the Rory Dame stuff, the youth stuff is absolutely horrifying, and that stuff is not isolated to Rory Dame's or Eclipse. No. So I think, yes, I'm not disagreeing with you at all that, like, yeah, things need to change. Some of the things that need to change are beyond the scope of the NWSL. They may not be beyond the scope of US soccer, though, which is why it's very important that they get that part of the message. And I'm not saying that US soccer is fully culpable for every terrible thing that happens, you know, across the sport in the country. They need to try and do what they can, right? And you can define that however you want.
Right.
And that's what they have to figure out.
They have to do more than they did previously. And when there's complaints from players, they can't basically turn a blind eye or conduct a sham investigation.
Right. So that's the more micro level mistakes. And it's why I think those are things you can point at. I think those are more easily correctable. But when you're trying to govern, you know, an entire country worth of a sport across all ages and genders and everything, that's when it's like, okay, we have to put a good system in place for this to be, if not completely stamp it out, because I don't think that's realistic, to put a way to fix it in these situations. Like, so every, you know, an education of, if this happens, here's what you do. And the club, you know, on the club level, they have to behave and do their own internal correcting of these things.
Yes.
So that's where it's like, yeah, this is the league needs to fix its stuff. The Federation has to fix its stuff. But the issues are so much bigger than that, and just kind of like American society and probably just human life in general. So
yeah.
Not to say life is all we know, it is fucked, but you know, it's not.
It's perfect. A microcosm of a lot of issues, of a lot of societal issues about, yes, power and gender and things like that.
Right. I think power is the gender, and the gender is mostly the sexualized thing, but I think the power is actually the primary one, and the sexual one comes because of the power, which is like a twisted, you know, anyway. So I don't know if you have any closing thoughts, Brian. I think we exhausted it. We could probably talk about this for hours if we went through the, you know, line by line. I'm going to keep saying it. I think if you're a Red Stars fan, you should read at least the Red Stars section.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to separate what's going on off the field with women's soccer with what's happened on the field, to be honest. It's difficult, but I still have some hope that eventually things like this will be stamped out, because, you know, if I ever have a daughter, I would want the daughter to play soccer. I think that there's still a lot of good that comes from it. But I would sure hope that she would never, ever, ever be subjected to what a lot of these players were subjected to.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's when you put the personal touch on it, that's when it gets terrifying, right? I mean, you can read it and compartmentalize it however you want or however you need to. But, you know, these are people who went through hell. That's terrible.
Yeah. And they're still going through it. There's references in the report of people having PTSD, of needing therapy specifically because of their experiences. And I just wouldn't want this to happen to anybody ever again.
Yep. In that we are in agreement, as unrealistic as that goal may be.
It's a little naive for me to hope that, because as long as you've got two people in a power dynamic, there's always going to be screwed up things that happen.
Or that can happen.
That can happen, yes.
Okay, well, I don't have a good transition from that, but we do need to talk about what happened on the field, because the Red Stars made the playoffs. This is the biggest game of their season when we get this report. So the Red Stars did it, right? They got the help from North Carolina, which had a draw on Saturday. And as we said last week, that was the best case scenario, because it meant Angel City like had to win like 15-0 or some absurd number that was totally unrealistic. So Angel City was basically eliminated, and the Red Stars had a chance with a win and get in at home. It wasn't always easy, but they got a 2-0 win. Of course, Mallory Pugh with the game-winning goal, that's fitting for the season. And Savannah McCaskill, a former Red Star, hitting a penalty off the outside of the post in the second half before Yuki Nagasato with a hell of a left-footed shot to make it 2-0. So the Red Stars are in, Brian.
They are in.
Does that make it a successful season on its own?
On its own, yeah, I think it does, considering all of the injuries that they had and all the attrition. I think it does make it a successful season. The team didn't have this talent level that it had in years past, partially due to departures, partially due to injuries. But for Chris Petrocelli to get them into the playoffs and for that team to stick with it, I think does make this a successful season. And maybe going forward, they can go into the postseason with a nothing to lose mindset. And who knows what could happen? NWSL is so condensed this year. I don't think there's such thing as an upset in the playoffs.
I agree with you. I feel like my brain is done after the try hard through that Sally Ace report.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree. I think this is we've said it before. I think I might have said it last week, that if the Red Stars make it, I think that with given the injuries and the absences, you know, some known before the season and some during the season, that this is a successful season. And, you know, San Diego falling to the 3 spot for a team that had been higher most of the regular season is kind of interesting. So that game's another week away. They're off international duty, which is, I think, kind of weird. I know that's often happens with the MLS calendar, that you get a window right around the start of the playoffs. So they don't play. They get an off weekend, or some of the players do, with Mallory Pugh, Alyssa Nair. So, yeah, we'll preview the San Diego Wave match more next week. I think the gist of it is successful season. They did it. Mallory Pugh, phenomenal season for them. Stayed healthy for the most part. Was excellent form. This is what they hoped they could get out of her when they traded for her. I think this is the type of player that she had the potential to be. And, you know, she's still a young player and, you know, injuries and all that. And this, you know, she has been the key player that Kristen Press was and Sam Kerr was. Side note, I don't want to go back to this too much, but do you think Sam Kerr leaving was at all related to this? She goes, you know, I've had enough of this too. That crossed my mind. You don't have a real answer for that,
I don't have a real answer, but boy, that's a great question. My first instinct is to say she was leaving regardless because of the money that Chelsea threw at her.
Yeah.
And I think playing in England now has a lot of appeal. And who's to say that there aren't systemic, I don't want to accuse anybody, but if there's systemic issues in one country, who's to say there's those issues aren't in another? So
yeah,
I think she took the bag, which is great. Good for her. I certainly endorse people taking the bag unless there's certain circumstances, but I don't know if this was related at all. And
yeah,
and frankly, I don't know. I tend to doubt it, but it wouldn't surprise me 100%.
Yeah. All right. Should we move on to the Fire, Brian?
Yeah, sure.
They won a game.
Yeah.
On the road. Not that it mattered.
Against the team or trying to make the playoffs.
Yeah, Cincinnati playing for something, still in the playoff race. So they might have been able to clinch in retrospect.
They would have been able to clinch, yeah.
Yeah. So that's incredible that the Fire got this result. So as for the game itself, Duran with two more goals. Look at this guy go.
Yeah, he's showing why the Fire were so excited about him when they signed him last year. By the way, do we mention that Gabriel Salina was out of the Cincinnati match with a head injury?
That's why he wasn't playing. Good call. Thank you.
Right. And that on the broadcast, Tyler Terran said concussion. Hopefully, Gabriel Salina is okay going forward for Sunday. It'd be nice to see him get maybe one final game with the Fire. But John Duran, two goals. And Brian Gutierrez, we've talked about his final product. It was pretty good Saturday night, too. Had a nice goal and two assists. Yeah. So the under 20 crowd playing well. And I'm just going to say this. It makes me feel so old. Combined, those guys are 37. I'm 37.
Good God.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, man. But John Duran, he's looking like quite a player right now. And it would be easy revisionist history to go back and say, well, if he had started most of the season with the Fire being the playoffs, we'll never know. But as we've both said on this podcast, he should have started earlier than he did. It was apparent pretty early that Kasper Schabilko just wasn't it.
Yeah, we're also looking at the Fire being right now, they're 7 points below the playoff line. How many points could he really have given them? That's a lot.
You could say that maybe there's a couple chances in 0-0 games that Schabilko didn't finish, or tie games that Duran might have. So you can maybe, let's generously say 3 or 4 points.
Right. Just,
that's just because of the position, and we don't even know game state, how things would have changed if Duran does finish one of those chances, like the one that Schabilko didn't finish against the Galaxy. Let's say Duran finished that. Maybe that the rest of that game plays different. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think 7 points for a player to then, we're not even talking about a player for an entire season. We're talking like a third of a season, a quarter of a season, if that. Because he played a decent amount of it. They were never going to play him. You know, Schabilko was always going to start. We're talking about starting him 5 to 8 games earlier at most. That seems aggressive even. Like, if you look back at the timeline, the earliest you would have argued for it, we're talking, you know, not a ton of games to make up.
Maybe after that LA game when Schabilko missed that chance.
Right.
But if you look at early in the season and the preseason, Duran did not look ready yet, but I think they could have pushed it a little bit more than they did.
I agree with that. Yeah, he did not look, he's improved as years gone on, as you'd expect out of a young player.
Right. And he still doesn't have a right foot to speak of.
Yeah, he's got work to do for sure. So with this discussion, there's been some transfer rumors around him, which I guess is no surprise. But what's the latest, Brian? Or if it's even the latest?
A lot of stuff has cropped up since the Cincinnati game that teams like Chelsea, Liverpool, a couple other European teams are sniffing around him that they'd like to get a deal done. Not a surprise. As I've been saying in the podcast, I'm not sure I expect him back next season. Maybe he is back next season, but I would not expect to be buying a 2024 John Duran Fire jersey, and maybe not even a 2023 if the Fire can get a good price for him.
Yeah, it's definitely, that's the new transfer rumor. We'll see. I don't think he's the same level of prospect at his position as Gaga is. Like, I think Gaga is, you know, at least among having played, you know, not a lot of 18-year-old goalkeepers and 17-year-old goalkeepers getting first team minutes around the world. So in that respect, Gaga, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff online of how he might actually be the top goalkeeper prospect for his age, at least because he's proven more. Duran, probably not quite that level at striker, but he is at playing at a position that is far more valuable in the transfer market than goalkeeper. So they might get a number, I don't want to say in the Gaga range, but it might be closer than I would have thought three months ago.
I think if they get an 8-digit offer, I think John Duran is gone, or at least.
Well, I'm not so sure they will. That's why I'm hesitating. Do you think they can?
I think it's possible. I mean, remember, still has on his resume that he was on that Guardian 60 list few years ago. Well, it's still that's something that still matters. I'm not saying whether it should. I'm saying it probably does. And I know that if you're the technical director
making decisions based on that list, then you should immediately be fired.
You'd be surprised.
FIFA career mode.
yeah. But he's got that on his resume. And I know that there was a lot of interest in him before the Fire signed him. There was even interest in him in that interim period between the Fire signing him and him coming to Chicago and a good season with a bad team. That can't hurt his stock. I don't think 8 figures is out of the realm of possibility for him.
I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, but I would be mildly surprised if it happened. Now, granted, if it's this upcoming winter window, I would be surprised, but maybe he continues to prove himself more. Here's the thing that I'm a little bit skeptical of is that because it's MLS, I don't know that there's going to be quite... Now, he had some respect before, but I still think as much as clubs are dipping into MLS and the American player in particular more, I still kind of think that, you're just scoring in MLS. Like, I still think there's a lot of that viewpoint that might depress the evaluation a little bit.
Right. But I think his age might help him in that. And all it takes is two teams to want him to start a bidding war. And then what do you know, the Fire have that $10 million offer and then they can move him on.
Yeah. All right, so we'll see. That's going to be one to follow over the next few months. But I have one more thing on the... Well, we'll talk about the New England game for like 2 seconds coming up. But I have one more thing, I guess, on the Charlotte game. No, the Cincinnati game, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's a Patreon question. As always, you can go to patreon.com/ChicagoSoccerConversation.
Sorry for bearing your question at the end, by the way, dear patron.
Yeah, well, priorities, like, come on.
Yeah, circumstances. Yeah.
It's the Fire, yeah. They could have asked a question about the Red Stars and it would have been mentioned already. Point is, all right, and this is calling me out specifically because I just put in the generic copy on our Patreon page. I think I might have thrown in that we'll talk about the meaningless Cincinnati game and all that or whatever I said. So I got called out. So this is me. You labeled the Fire game as meaningless in your show notes. Was it? I think there's a great deal to learn from the fact that they played competently without any of their 3 DPs. Arguably, this match was a better example of Ezra's system and ethos than any fixture where Shaqiri, Jimenez, and Torres were all collectively available.
That's an interesting point, but I want to see what that ethos looks like when games matter, when teams do have something to lose. And I would have wanted to see more young kids play. That lineup... Like, I don't need to see John Espinoza play for the Fire anymore. I think we know what he is. I don't know if he played. I don't need to see Stanislav Ivanov play. We know what he is. I would have liked to have seen more young kids. It could have had more meaning than it did, but that was something that struck me that looked like there was a nice connection between Gutierrez and Duran and Chris Mueller without Jordan Shaqiri on the field, without Gaston Jimenez on the field, without Jairo Torres. That was about the only thing that I took from the match. But it's easier to do that when you know you have nothing to lose. I want to see that ethos in a game that matters. And let's be honest, we saw a lot of the fire this year in games that mattered, and the results weren't optimal.
Okay, so that's interesting because I expected you to, you know, you're the play the kids guy, and I know you're basically making that argument a little bit in this, in what you just said there. I kind of expected you to be like, well, the kids played well and that matters, because I obviously was the one who wrote the description saying we'll talk about the meaningless fire game. I'm of the opinion that that game didn't matter at all. And I was kind of expecting you to convince me, or try to convince me, why it mattered, and you did not. So
it's important. It's important in a relationship like ours for there to be surprises,
or at least some agreement. I feel like all we've been doing is arguing nuance this episode.
Are you sure we're not married?
Oh God, I hope not. This episode, we're arguing despite agreeing on multiple opinion on multiple fronts, is just. It's special. Yeah.
Yeah. It's special. It shows our chemistry.
Yeah. So, all right, we'll get into one more thing in the fire. I'll just mention the fire close out the season Sunday against New England. It is a 1:30 kickoff on WGN. It is in Bridgeview and it's meaningless, as we just established, because neither team is fighting for the playoffs.
Yeah. The most interesting thing for me this weekend, a couple, see what the attendance is in Bridgeview on the 25th anniversary match day before the Fire and Section 8 are hosting a anniversary party to celebrate this milestone for the club. There'll be, I'll have a chance to talk to some luminaries from earlier in the Fire history. So the game itself, unless somebody scores like 5 goals or something really off the wall happens, will be nothing more than a footnote.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the 25th anniversary, because that is a pretty big deal in the Fire community. I don't want to say an accomplishment. It is a milestone, right?
It is an accomplishment for soccer in this country for any team or league to last 25 years.
That's fair.
I think 25 years ago, would you have bet on the Fire to still be around in 2022? And would you have bet on MLS to still be around and actually growing?
I wasn't old enough or informed enough to have an opinion on that.
I wasn't either. But I'm just saying, would an average soccer...
I understand your point, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know if you would have bet on that. I don't know. But
yeah,
Fire around. They'll be around for the foreseeable future, of course. MLS will be around for the foreseeable future. So I think it is worth celebrating. Now, of course, the team on the field, not so much. But for soccer teams and leagues in this country to be around after a quarter century, not bad that it has outlived the famed NASL.
Yeah. By a long shot. I do want to give an extra mention to the actual anniversary, I guess, party or event or whatever they want to call it. Is at the Museum of Science and Industry, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I've heard the Fire putting some pretty good resources and making it pretty cool. There's going to be, you know, former players, coaches, fans, all that. So it is a big deal within the Fire community for sure. And again, as we mentioned, by the circumstances of with the Red Stars, with going on with them, that stuff kind of got pushed aside this week. But definitely a big deal. And maybe we can talk about it in retrospect next week. Assuming it'll be the Red Stars will be off, the Fire playing a dead rubber game, we can hit up more of these important things that aren't, the state of the existence of the Red Stars, I guess.
Right, and this on-field state of the Fire, but kudos to the Fire for pouring some money and some effort into this. It's on Twitter today, they unveiled their special jerseys for the game. It's the same jerseys, but the numbers are red, with a little 25th anniversary silver logos on the numbers. So that'll be pretty cool. Nice little touches like that. And I think it's appropriate, the game's in Bridgeview, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, they've spent more of their history there than at Soldier Field.
Is that true? Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, 14 seasons.
What's the math?
14 seasons. I'm no mathologist, but 14 is more than half of 25.
It was 06 to, yeah, or, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, wow. I never really thought about it before. It's a good point.
Yeah. So on Wednesday, there was some news out of the goalkeeping position. Ezra Hendrickson said that Chris Brady will get his first start Sunday against New England. He reiterated that he didn't want to throw Brady into the deep end in Cincinnati, that he thought that was a better spot for Spencer Ritchie. So Chris Brady will start Sunday. Gabriel Slonina is in concussion protocol after a collision last week in practice with Stanislav Ivanov. So I guess now this game does have some meaning, because I will be very interested to see what Chris Brady shows. Now, it's one game, one meaningless game, but I'm intrigued, I'm curious, and I know what I'm writing about off of Sunday's game.
Brian finally gets his wish. You've been asking for this for, what, a month or two now?
Yeah, but I'm not the only person who gets their wish. A lot of people have wanted to see this. And I'm sure Chris Brady is one of the people who wanted yeah. this.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity for him, a good experience. I think it's a good low-pressure environment for what I'm sure will be a nervous match for him, or at least a nervous start to the match. I can't imagine, you confidence or not, I think you're probably going to come in with some nerves. So I think this is the perfect opportunity to be like, hey, we're not worried about the result. We want you to learn from this. We want you to play well. We want you to communicate with your teammates and do what you're capable of doing. But, you know, if he flubs something like we've seen Slonina do it multiple times this season, no big deal. And it's a learning moment. It's a free learning experience. You can't beat that. Although I do think, and this is something we've talked about on this show before, I'm not a huge fan of his on when we compare him to Gaga Slonina. Like, I don't think that's fair to him. I don't think it's fair to Gaga. I don't think it's fair to the Fire. He's not that level of prospect. And it doesn't mean he's not a good prospect. He may still be the future of the goalkeeping position for the Fire. I'm not sure I think he's the future next year. I'm not even sure the Fire think that. I guess we'll find out with how the offseason goes. But this yeah. is a good opportunity, and I think people just need to tamp down the expectations and the hype and just let him go out there and do a thing. Because if you compare him to Gaga, it's probably not going to be satisfactory.
Right. No, he's just not that. And also reminds me about Gaga that, unfortunately, I mean, if he's not back on loan next season, his Fire career is over, and it ended with that loss to Charlotte. I know I wasn't the only person who was kind of hoping to see both of them get some playing time on Sunday. Maybe there would be like a ceremonial passing of the gloves from between the two or whatever. But a little sad that Gabriel Slonina's last game with the Fire could very well be a game that they lost 3-2, and that he'll be watching the last two games with the Fire because of being in the concussion protocol. Kind of sad.
It is kind of sad. And I'm going to go on a full tangent here, Brian.
Okay.
Do you, when you play FIFA career mode or whatever you do over the years, have you ever, or Madden or pick your whatever thing, have you ever made a lineup move based on, oh, this guy's out of contract and I'm not going to keep him. I need to give him like send off minutes. I've done that stupid stuff in FIFA.
Oh, of course. I have too.
That weird.
I have two, and maybe this is something that'll mimic real life, but I'm doing a franchise mode with the White Sox, and after 2022, and this is MLB The Show, I let go of Jose Abreu. I didn't re-sign him to kind of clear up that logjam that the Sox have, and I was even thinking in my head, what would the press release say from when the White Sox announced that? So yes, I've done that, and are we dorks?
Yes, that's okay, though.
That's fine. We're among friends. We're all dorks. It's totally fine. You got to own who you are. But the Fire had a chance to do something like that in real life.
All right, one more thing. I know you want to talk about it regards to Shaqiri. We've been kind of talking about this. This is the third episode in a row we're talking about Shaqiri's commitment to the Fire. Brian, take it away.
Yeah, so last Wednesday in Ezra Hendrickson's weekly availability, I pretty much put it right to Ezra about Shaqiri's commitment to the Fire, discussing the fact that he left the fateful Charlotte match early with an injury, but then played 130 minutes with Switzerland a week later, including two matches in 4 days. And Ezra Hendrickson defended Jordan Shaqiri.
Not at all. As far as questioning his commitment, I think Shaq came in with a commitment to help get this organization back to where it belongs to. And I think he's shown that throughout the entire year. Even when he was carrying injuries, he played. You know, some that wasn't the case for every player on the squad this year. So I think his commitment to this team is very high. And but you know, he knows his body and he knows what he's feeling. We're coming back off the road of two road games, which, you know, he wasn't healthy, but he played in both of those games against New England, against Columbus, even in Montreal he played. So, you know, he put it out there. You know, it was a succession of games, and he felt it late in the Charlotte match. And you know, if Shaq says that he's feeling it, I truly believe him, because he's shown to me as a coach that throughout the year he was able to play, you know, with some injuries. And if he's not able to go, it means it's really, really bothering him. And, you know, you can't blame a player for not wanting to, you know, to get injured, you know, or to feel something and pretend that it's not there, and then it ended up being worse. But, you know, as far as representing his country, you know, we all want to represent our country. And, he had the opportunity. He's a big part of what they're doing. And so I had no problem with him, you know, being able to play. You know, obviously he wasn't able to play 90 minutes, but he was able to play in both games for about, you know, 60, 65 minutes each game. But his commitment to the Fire is real, and it's 100%. And I don't question that at all. I mean, he's shown that to us throughout the year.
It's an interesting point that Ezra Hendrickson made. First, there was a little bit of a sideswipe at maybe other players who were injured and didn't play. It may be implying that they could have played through things. And yeah, Jordan Shaqiri, there were times when he played hurt. You could see it clearly. There were also times, especially the Dallas match early in the season, when he played right after an international window, maybe to the Fire's detriment. So that was an interesting counterpoint to some of the other circumstantial evidence. I'm glad I asked the question, and I'm glad Ezra Hendrickson answered it. Now, does that mean that he's fully committed, or that he's prioritizing the Fire as much as the Swiss national team? I don't know. And to be honest, I wrote in the paper Saturday that, let's say he does skip the last two matches, and he already didn't play in Cincinnati, and if he doesn't play this weekend against New England, I don't really have an issue with that. Those games are meaningless for him, risking an injury when he doesn't need that. But I still think there are questions about why he left that Charlotte match. Looking forward, I don't really care if he plays Sunday against New England, but looking back, I think there still are some questions about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't think I am. It's not a surprise to see that he was not. Even then, I'm like hesitating to say this, but if that was the case, that he was thinking towards the World Cup, no one should be surprised. Let's put it, that's probably the safest, most conservative way to say that.
Yeah,
this was part of what you get with signing him, right? It could have gone that it fired him up to be more motivated. Maybe it did. I don't know. Didn't look like it. He wasn't bad. I think you can hope for more next year with a better team around him. I think he's still a good MLS player, but he wasn't good enough this year to dominate a game on his own, like we've seen Ladero in Seattle, Reynoso in Minnesota. I'm missing other 10s. It was an exhaustive list, but the Fire paid him to be that level of player, and he was not that level of player.
Right. 18 goal involvements this season. That's not
a bad number.
It's not a bad number at all.
I mean, those are penalties though, so that's another thing.
Right. You have to look into that. But he was fine, but fine wasn't what they were hoping for from him and what they needed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the commitment thing is fair, and it'll be interesting to see what it looks on the other end of that. And you know, you asked me last week if they should move on from him, and I think they should. But I also think you need to move on from Jimenez first. I think you have to give Torres another year. I'm not thrilled about it if I'm a Fire fan, but like, I think you kind of have to give him that chance, because it's just too hard to go through that process. You know, but if Jimenez was an all-star level eight or whatever you want to call it, and Torres was like a David Akam level winger, you know, David Akam with the Fire, of course, I mean.
Right.
I think you'd be fine with Shaqiri as what he was, and I think he'd look better than what he was. But I also think you want more from him anyway.
Yeah, you do. Next year, if he's around, will be a very interesting season because, yeah, he won't have the World Cup as that carrot. But at the same point, he won't have to worry as much about preserving health for the World Cup. So,
yeah,
it could go either way.
Yeah, it could. And as we said, I don't know how the Fire get better in the offseason.
Yeah, we'll jump into that, I'm sure. And I'll jump into that in print. But I don't know. They've got their roster seems like it's locked down unless they get very aggressive by just trading guys or selling guys on.
Well, the depth can get better and some of the young guys can improve, but without replacing some of the DPs, it's very difficult. Not very difficult, but it's difficult. It's doable, right, but difficult.
Yeah, and I don't love the trajectory of Gaston Jimenez, DP aside. As we've said, a midfielder coming off significant hamstring surgery, that's not something that you want to see. Man, it's going to be another year, isn't it?